every chance we get.
Does Mr. Potter like to play checkers? Asked Frankie.
As a matter of fact, he does.
And so does Mr. Howard. Now, are you going to wear me out with questions?
He's just excited, said Mike. We never thought we'd be in a house nice as this, or that we'd get to stay together.
Mrs. Potter's face softened. It's been a day of surprises for all of us. Now, into the tub. We have chicken and potatoes for dinner. But since you have nothing decent to wear to the table, I'll bring up your food on a tray.
On a tray?
Said Frankie.
I never had dinner on a tray.
Mrs. Potter tried not to smile. I'll be back to show you to the tower room. Frankie's eyes widened.
We get to sleep in a tower?
Get on with the bathing now. She pulled the door shut.
She's nice,
said Frankie. Mike nodded. Mrs. Potter reminded him of Granny. All business and practicality, but at the same time, mothering them like a hen. That night, Mike leaned back against the pillows in the four-posted double bed. The tower was the bedroom on the second floor beneath the cone-shaped roof. A mahogany dresser stood against one wall. Woven rugs covered the hardwood floors, and needlepoint pillows sat propped in the window seat. It was a far cry from Bishop's. The door opened. Frankie slipped inside, wearing one of Mr. Howard's nightshirts, the sleeves rolled up. He leaped onto the bed next to Mike.
Did you brush your teeth?
Frankie nodded, crawling under the sheet. Mike turned off the lamp. A cricket chirped.
It's awful quiet, said Frankie.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Mike, I'm scared.
Want me to keep the light on?
No, I'm not scared of the dark.
Frankie scooted closer and put an arm across Mike's chest.
I'm scared if I close my eyes and go to sleep, I might wake up at Bishop's.
I know, said Mike. But I promise you'll wake up here.
Mike stared into the shadows. His mind couldn't settle with all that had happened or was said that day. She is a pianist of great talent. Must adopt. Only doing what's required. You're out of time. She's not been her usual self. All she's been through. Ifs and maybes. Mike heard Frankie's breathing change and knew he was already asleep. He gently lifted Frankie's hand and tucked the sheet around him. The kid smelled like soap and the chicken from dinner. And it hadn't been creamed chicken either. It had been plump, roasted drumsticks. What if it was all a dream? Just in case. Mike battled to keep his eyes open. But he lost. Chapter 10. At first, Mike didn't know where he was. He sat up, blinking and staring into the bedroom until the events of yesterday came back to him. Next to him, Frankie rolled over, still sleeping. The clothes they'd worn when they arrived had been washed and folded and placed on a low bench at the end of the bed. Mike dressed and walked downstairs, where all was still quiet. The double doors to the library were open. Mike stepped inside. It was dim and cave-like. Every window was covered with wooden shutters and closed tight. He studied the paneled walls, the fringed lampshades, and the large desk angled across a corner. His eyes drifted to the floor-to-ceiling bookcases filled with books and the sliding ladder that stretched to the topmost shelves. A collection of metronomes sat on a small round table. Where was the piano? Retracing his steps, he crossed the entry hall to another set of double doors. He opened one and sucked in his breath. The morning sun streamed through the tall windows, illuminating tiny specks of dust in the air. Potted palms appointed each corner. In the middle of the room sat the most magnificent instrument Mike had ever seen. A concert grand. It had to be 9 feet from keyboard to end. Once, Granny had taken him to buy sheet music, and the shop owner had a baby grand. He let Mike play it. The notes had seemed to leap from inside the instrument. the sound flying around the room.
What power would an even larger piano hold?
Mike ran his hands over the shiny ebony wood. He raised the lid and pulled the prop into place. For a few moments, he gazed at the intricate insides, the tuning pins, the treble and bass strings, the soundboard and the hammers. Sliding onto the bench, he squeezed his hands into fists, released them, and spread his fingers wide.
Hadn't Mr. Howard said the piano sorely needed playing?
Hadn't they been chosen from bishops because they were musical? If Mrs. Sturbridge heard someone playing, maybe she'd be pleased. Was that one of the ifs and maybes? A music book stood on the stand. He flipped the pages until he came to the Chopin Nocturne, number 20. He positioned his hands, feeling the desire, like a magnet drawing his fingertips closer. He played the opening chords. The room filled with the rich timbre of the piano and its full-bodied tone. It wasn't like any piano he'd ever heard before. The high notes sounded brighter, the low ones darker and more ominous. He began several times. At first, his phrasing was stilted, unpracticed. Then he felt himself descend into the music. He remembered Granny teaching him the piece when he was 9. When he finished the first pass, he heard her voice.
"Once more. But first, I'm going to open the window so the entire neighborhood can hear you play."
Mike succumbed to the melancholy notes, the insinuations of a march, the delicate filigree, and the final runs slower and slower until the final haunting note. He could almost sense Granny next to him on the piano bench and hear his mother humming. He was startled by a strange sound, a cross between a squeak and a gasp, and he looked up. Mrs. Sturbridge stood in the doorway, her hand on her heart, looking as if she'd seen a ghost. Before Mike could say a word, Mrs. Potter rushed into the room.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. I didn't hear him come down."
She took Mike's arm and led him to the kitchen. She sat him down at the table.
"As much as your playing filled my heart, it pains me to say you must leave the piano be. It's never to be touched."
Her eyes filled with regret.
"It's a shame. Beautiful instrument like that, just begging to be played. And to think of all the music that used to come from it."
"I don't understand," said Mike. "Mr. Howard said..."
Mrs. Potter held up a hand to interrupt.
"Lots of things don't make sense around here. You'll get used to it. Now, go get your brother and come to the kitchen for breakfast. Mr. Howard will be over shortly to take you to town for new clothes." "Is she coming with us?"
If so, Mike could apologize about the piano and explain how he and Frankie used to look cleaner and nicer. Mrs. Potter shook her head.
"She has plans and won't be back till after dinner. And she's not inclined to being with you boys just yet. Go on now."
Mike headed upstairs to retrieve Frankie. Why had she adopted them if she didn't want to be with them? How much more didn't make sense around here? Chapter 11. Mike held Frankie's hand as they hurried after Mr. Howard, who walked down Amaryllis Drive with brisk purpose, whistling all the while. Striding past, he pointed out his house on the corner. Two enormous elms grew on either side of the center walkway, the branches almost touching in the middle. "It's the same age and style as Mrs. Sturbridge's, but I've had it all remodeled." He pulled his watch from his pocket. "Come on, boys. If we cut through the park and hurry, we can catch the next trolley." Mike took longer strides to keep up. 2 blocks down, Mr. Howard pointed to the park square, where a gazebo sat in the center. They dashed through to the boulevard on the other side, just in time to catch the approaching trolley. Within a few stops, the houses changed from older, stately homes to more modest bungalows. Mile by mile, the buildings grew taller. When the trolley rattled to a stop in the bustle of downtown Philadelphia, they stepped off. Even though it was hotter and more humid here within the narrow streets, where a breeze couldn't find its way, Mike felt more at home. It reminded him of Granny's neighborhood. Walk-up apartments, girls jumping rope across the sidewalk, boys playing pimpleball in the street, cars and trucks honking. He looked up, hoping to see a window with a hand-printed sign for piano lessons, knowing full well he wasn't anywhere near where he used to live. When Mr. Howard led them through the revolving doors of Highlander's department store, the noise fell away. Inside, everything was shined and polished. The glass cases, the merchandise, the faces of the salesmen and salesladies. Even the air smelled expensive. All the customers wore what looked like their Sunday best. Mike ran his hands over his clothes, feeling all wrong. "Boys, go on up to the third floor. The young gentleman's department," said Mr. Howard. "I'll meet you there. I need to take care of Mrs. Sturbridge's account in the office first." Mike and Frankie slowly walked between cases, topped with gloves and scarves, umbrellas, wallets, hats, and perfumery. Frankie stopped to gawk at a display of glass figurines. A saleslady rushed forward and frowned. Mike pulled Frankie toward the elevator.
"Third floor,"
he told the elevator operator. The man looked at them and sniffed. He swept his fingers over the lapels of his blue suit, as if brushing away dirt.
"Boys, you cannot run around rip-shod through this establishment."
"We weren't running," said Frankie.
"Do you plan on purchasing something?"
asked the man.
"Yes, sir," said Mike. "In the young gentleman's department."
The man's eyes inspected them. He signaled to a salesman, who hurried over. The two men whispered. Mike heard only bits of what they said. "No money, one thing in mind, little thieves." Mike felt his face grow hot and knew it was reddening. The salesman signaled to several nearby clerks, then grabbed Frankie's arm.
"Boys, let me escort you back outside. I think you are in the wrong place."
Frankie jerked his arm away and clung to Mike.
"Leave us alone!"
The clerks hurried forward and spread their arms wide, surrounding them. The salesman grabbed the neck of Mike's shirt and twisted his right arm behind his back, marching him toward the door. Mike panicked.
"Let me go! What are you doing?"
He had never been manhandled like this before. He tried to wriggle from the man's grip. The salesman tightened his hold and whispered in his ear,
"Find another store to pilfer."
Frankie began to scream.
"Stop! Stop!"
He lunged forward, pounding the man with his fists.
"Call the police!"
yelled the elevator operator. Mr. Howard's voice boomed.
"Take your hands off those boys and step aside, or I'll call the authorities. And I don't mean the police. I mean Mr. Highlander himself."
The salesman released Mike and backed away. Mike's entire body shook. Tears stung his eyes. They had thought they were thieves. He'd never stolen a thing in his life. Mr. Howard strode closer and put an arm around each of them. "You boys okay?"
"They wanted us to leave. They wanted to take Mike away,"
whimpered Frankie.
"For no reason."
"We'll see about that." Mr. Howard looked at one of the salesmen. "Call the store manager at once."
Mr. Howard sat in an overstuffed chair in the young gentleman's department, with Frankie on his lap and Mike at his side.
"My apologies, Mr. Howard,"
said the store manager, a short man with a skinny mustache. He paced in front of them.
"It was a misunderstanding. We had no way of knowing these boys were with you."
Mr. Howard raised his eyebrows. "As I recall, over the years, my client, Mrs. Sturbridge, has spent a fair amount of money in this store, and in this very department."
"Oh, yes, sir, she has, indeed."
"These boys are her wards," said Mr. Howard. "They are clean and polite. They're poorly dressed, yes, but does that make them shoplifters?"
"No. It makes them in need of new clothes, which is why we're here. There's something very wrong about how they were treated, sir, when they were doing exactly what I told them. Do you think I need to mention this to Mr. Highlander?"
"Oh, no, Mr. Howard,"
stammered the store manager. He snapped his fingers and a young salesman stepped forward.
"Charles will assist you," No reason ever to mention it again, and you can be sure I'll talk to the employees. I'll call a special meeting. Count on it.
Fine, then, said Mr. Howard. I need a wardrobe for each of these young gentlemen. 4 shirts, 3 pair of trousers, stockings, romper togs for unders, suspenders, and a cap, wool or felt. Make one of the pants and shirts for dress, and throw in a vest and tie for each. Oh, and we'd better have shoes. He looked at their feet. 2 pair. Brown lace-up leathers for every day, and black Oxfords for dress. Frankie grinned at Mike. Mike couldn't smile back. The embarrassment still smarted, and his face still pulsed from the humiliation. He looked down as Charles ushered them into a dressing room. Had Mrs. Sturbridge thought the same when she first saw them? Had she wondered if they were little thieves, too?
"I'll be sitting right here, boys, reading the paper," said Mr. Howard. "When you're ready, come out and show me your outfits."
Behind the curtain, Mike relaxed. He and Frankie spent an hour trying on clothes and darting back and forth to Mr. Howard for approval. When they were alone in the dressing room, they made goofy faces at each other in the mirror. Once fitted, they followed Mr. Howard, now laden with parcels, outside to the front of Highlanders.
"Thank you, Mr. Howard," said Mike, "for bringing us. We never had so much new or nice at one time. And thank you for standing up for us, too."
Mr. Howard smiled. "You have just as much right to be in that store as the next person, so you're welcome. But it's Uni you should thank for your clothes. She's your benefactor." Mike nodded.
"I will, sir. First chance I get." "Uni?"
Frankie crinkled his nose.
"Her given name is Eunice," said Mr. Howard. "I started calling her Uni when we were children."
"What should we call her?" asked Frankie. "She didn't like it when I asked her if she was going to be our mother."
"No. Well, let's give her some time," said Mr. Howard. "For now, just Ma'am or Mrs. Sturbridge will do."
As they headed down the street, Mike couldn't stop peeking at himself in store windows. Was it really him? He didn't look at all like something dragged from the gutter. He looked smart and new, as if he belonged with Mr. Howard. Would Mrs. Sturbridge, or Ma'am, or whatever they called her, agree?
Chapter 12.
On the way back to the trolley stop, Frankie skipped ahead of Mike and Mr. Howard and stopped in front of a shop window. He turned, wide-eyed, waving for them to hurry. Mike jogged to him.
"What is it, kid?"
"It's them,"
he said, pointing to a large poster displayed in the window of Wilkinson's Music Emporium.
"It's the Harmonica Wizards."
Frankie pressed his nose on the glass. Mike looked up at the poster of over 60 boys in military-style uniforms, capes and plumed hats. A tiny man wearing a red apron stepped from the shop. His gray mustache had been waxed into an old-fashioned handlebar, curling up on both ends.
"Good day, gentlemen," he nodded toward the poster. "Aren't they something? The famous Philadelphia Harmonica Band. Are you boys going to enter the contest? Still plenty of time."
"Sir, what's all this?" asked Mr. Howard.
"Citywide competition in August. Thousands of children taking lessons all over Philadelphia. Lots of prizes, including musical instruments. It's an audition of sorts. Top 5 winners are invited to join the band and travel all over. They have their own women's auxiliary raising money for uniforms, finding homes for boys to board in, even sending them to college."
Frankie nodded as if he were an expert.
"We were going to try out so we could get out of the orphanage, but we don't have to now, 'cause we got adopted."
"Well, that's wonderful. Doesn't mean you still can't enter for the fun of it," said Mr. Wilkinson.
"But you gotta have the official harmonica, and you gotta be 10 years old, except if you're a mascot. See?"
Frankie pointed to the young boy in the poster.
"That's right. The youngster is a novelty and only plays with the band when it's in town. Doesn't travel with him. Band's got all sorts of rules about such things. But he's sure a crowd-pleaser in that uniform."
He winked at Frankie.
"And you're right about the harmonica. has to be the Honer Marine Band in the key of C. I just received a shipment from the warehouse yesterday, and they're going like hotcakes. Only 65 cents each.
He pulled a striped handkerchief from his apron pocket and began blotting his forehead.
Speaking of hotcakes, this weather is a steamy kitchen. The heat has about got me beat.
Frankie looked up at Mr. Howard.
Mrs. Pennyweather took away the harmonicas Granny bought for us.
Mr. Howard smiled.
Mr. Wilkinson, I don't think we're interested in the contest, but two harmonicas might just be the ticket.
Right this way, said Mr. Wilkinson.
He opened the shop door, and a bell on the frame jingled. Mr. Howard and Frankie followed Mr. Wilkinson to the counter near the register.
There are kittens underfoot, so watch your step, said Mr. Wilkinson. Three of 'em somewhere in the store.
Mike walked down the narrow center aisle, mindful of where he stepped, and savoring the smell of bow rosin, leather cases, and wood polish. His eyes couldn't look fast enough at all the instruments that crowded every available space. Trumpets in a glass case, cellos propped at attention, violins suspended from the ceiling, crash cymbals and snare drums, a bass drum on a pedestal. It reminded him of the shop where Granny used to take him to buy sheet music.
"Isn't it wonderful?" she'd say. "Music is just waiting to escape from all these instruments."
He smiled, remembering how he'd always expected to see a string of black notes fleeing from the bell of a tuba or a trombone. Frankie ran toward him, holding a calico kitten in one hand and a new harmonica in the other.
"Look, Mike, it comes with an instruction booklet with songs. Listen."
He ran his mouth over the harmonica.
"Doesn't it sound grand? I took the last one by the register, but Mr. Wilkinson said for you to go to the back counter and get one from the carton he just opened."
Frankie wandered back to where Mr. Howard and Mr. Wilkinson stood together, talking. Mike worked his way to the back of the store until he reached a counter in front of a curtained storeroom. On top sat a big open carton filled with slim cases. Mike lifted one and opened it. Inside, 12 individual boxes lay in a row, each imprinted with a photo of the United States Marine Band. The last box on the bottom caught his eye. The blue border seemed brighter than the rest, the red lettering bolder, the photograph of the Marine Band sharper. When he lifted the box, he could have sworn he heard a chord erupt, like a high-pitched chime. He glanced around. It must have been Mr. Wilkinson's cash register. Mike opened the box, picked up the harmonica, and turned it over. He noticed a small red, hand-painted M on one edge. He lifted the harmonica to his lips, ran the scale, and then played the last six notes of America the Beautiful. During the pause after the final note and before his next breath, all the instruments in the shop struck a long, echoing chord. He spun around, his eyes darting to the motionless instruments. No one else was around. Everything was quiet. It was stuffy in the shop, and he felt lightheaded. He swiped at his brow, now beaded with perspiration, and put the harmonica back in its box. He clutched it in his hand as he headed toward the front. He was escorted by a chorus of sounds, the hoots of clarinets, the swish, swish of the snare drum, the plucking of violin strings, and the deep strum of the cello. When he passed the trumpets, a fanfare blasted. He glanced over his shoulder. Everything looked the same. Had Granny been right? Was the music escaping? Or was this all some clever trick of Mr. Wilkinson's? A kitten followed him, pawing at his ankles. With each step, the space around him felt more crowded and the air thicker.
"'Have already paid,' said Mr. Howard when Mike reached him. "'I see you chose a harmonica.' Mike nodded. Mr. Wilkinson winked at him.
"'I always say the instrument chooses the musician instead of the other way around.'
He nodded to Mr. Howard.
"'Thank you for your business.'
As they walked out and the door swung shut behind them, the bell on the frame fluttered like a giddy piccolo. Outside, Mike rubbed his forehead. Maybe the heat had him beat, too. Even the harmonica felt warm in his hand. He leaned toward Frankie.
"'You hear anything funny in there?'
"'No, but guess what? Mr. Howard said Mr. Potter is the best harmonica player he's ever heard in his entire life. And tomorrow's his day off, and maybe he can teach us some songs.'
All the way to the trolley stop, Mike and Frankie played the harmonicas. Mike's sounded different from Frankie's. His had a tone he couldn't explain. It seemed older and rounder somehow. As he played songs he already knew by heart, his steps became more buoyant, and his heart filled with something he had not felt for a long while. Was it happiness? The trolley stopped, bell clanging. Mr. Howard smiled and said, "Come on, boys, time to head home." Frankie grabbed Mike's hand and squeezed it. Mike looked at the kid's smiling face and squeezed in return. Mr. Howard had said home. Maybe this time they could catch a break and everything would go right.
Chapter 13
Mr. Potter could make the harmonica sound like a train on a track, a baby crying, or rain falling in the wind. Sunday afternoon, Mike and Frankie sat on a bench under a shade tree next to the Potter's cottage, hypnotized by his playing. Mike couldn't take his eyes from Mr. Potter's hands or his mouth, and the way his head swayed with the music. He recognized familiar melodies, but they were peppered with repeating rhythms. The sound seemed to transport him to another place and time, someplace ancient and earthy. The beat started and stopped, questioned and answered. Mike had never heard anything like it before. When Mr. Potter paused, Mike asked, "What is that sound?" Mr. Potter nodded and grinned.
"Kinda catches you, doesn't it? Called the blues."
"Why?"
asked Frankie.
"Ever heard someone say they're feeling blue?"
asked Mr. Potter.
"Means sad, where they got the melancholies about life. So blues music is about all the trials and tribulations people got in their hearts from living. It's about what folks want but don't have. Blues is a song begging for its life."
"But the music doesn't sound sad all the time," said Mike.
"No, the songs are full of something else, too," said Mr. Potter. "That's the thing. No matter how much you don't have, there's always so much more of life to be had. So no matter how much sadness is in a song, there's equal amount of maybe things will get better someday soon."
"Can you make any song the blues?" asked Mike.
"Not always. But you can make most sound bluesy."
Frankie laughed.
"Bluesy? That's funny."
"Means you can give most any song the flavor of the blues."
Mr. Potter put his harmonica to his lips and played Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. It was the same melody their mom used to sing, but with repeating phrases. At the end, Mr. Potter seemed to goad the song into wailing.
"How did you do that?" asked Mike.
"Easy," Mr. Potter grinned. "You take the tune and break it up. Then do over some of the lines, then sprinkle in some grit from your insides. You played the song like you're testifying to the feelings you hold in your heart. Happy, sad, angry. Mike, you follow what I do.
He played two chords. Mike repeated them. He played a note, bending it. Mike copied him. Mr. Potter made each phrase different from the last. Back and forth they went. First Mr. Potter and then Mike. Short notes, like words, followed by longer phrases, like full sentences. Then, entire paragraphs of music, as if the two of them were having a conversation. When they were done, Frankie clapped.
"Now me,"
he said. Mr. Potter started over, making the phrases simpler. After Frankie caught on, Mike joined in. In the shade of the tree, with the sounds of the three harmonicas talking to one another, and all that had happened to them in the last few days, Mike dared to let another sliver of happiness creep into his heart. Mrs. Potter called to Frankie and Mike from the back door of the main house and waved them over. Frankie ran ahead. Mr. Potter pointed to Mike's harmonica.
"That is something special. Got a quality I never heard before."
Mike nodded.
I feel different when I play it.
Mr. Potter smiled.
"Sometimes an instrument does that to a person. Makes the world seem brighter, with more possibilities."
Mike understood what he meant. He'd felt it. He held out the harmonica, pointing to the tiny, scroll-like M on the pear wood edge that he'd noticed yesterday.
"What's this mean, Mr. Potter?"
"I don't know. Never saw such a thing. Frankie's have it?"
Mike shook his head.
"No, I checked."
"Probably put there by its maker. That harmonica isn't the only thing special. You got a natural talent. Mrs. Potter told me about your piano playing. Now I know what she was going on about. Wait here."
Mr. Potter went into the cottage. A few minutes later, he came back and handed Mike a thick book of music with harmonica tabs.
"You can borrow this a while. It'll pique your interest just fine. You gonna come back tomorrow and jam with me some more?"
Mike nodded.
"Thank you. Yes, sir."
Slowly, Mike made his way toward the house, playing the songs he'd just learned. When a movement caught his eye, he glanced up at a second-story window. Mrs. Sturbridge stood watching him, but before he could raise his hand to wave, she disappeared, and the draperies plunged closed. He hadn't had an opportunity to apologize for playing the piano yesterday. Was she still upset about that? Or was it something else? Mrs. Sturbridge's strange behavior continued. For 2 weeks, they hardly saw her. Mrs. Potter kept them busy with a schedule of meals and playtime and chores. Mr. Potter let Frankie follow him around like a puppy. Mr. Howard came every few evenings and ate dinner with them, staying after to play catch on the lawn or a game of checkers on the porch. He took them to the park on weekends. She never joined them. Mike tried to tell himself it didn't matter, that just being together was enough for him and Frankie. But he saw how the kid's eyes followed Mrs. Sturbridge when she whisked past them. He felt Frankie's longing to be part of a family again. And sometimes, in his heart of hearts, Mike even dared to wish the same for himself. He took comfort in the blues. He practiced as much as he could with Mr. Potter, working through the music book and making each song bluesy. Every time he played, he felt buoyed, lifted up, and full of possibility, as if he were riding on the shoulders of some unknown power. He could sense something optimistic in his heart, making his music shine from the inside out. In the hours between playing, though, he felt confused and unsettled. Something about being on Amaryllis Drive was rotten. The night before the 4th of July, Mike sat on his side of the bed, flipping through the pages of the book Mr. Potter had given him and studying the music. He started at the beginning with "Good Night, Ladies," followed by "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow," and Oh, Susanna. Frankie came into the bedroom and climbed up next to him.
Play me a song, please.
Mike obliged, easing into My Old Kentucky Home.
That was good,
said Frankie, his eyes already drooping.
Mike, do you think tomorrow?
His eyes closed and his forehead wrinkled as if he were wishing hard for something. Mike didn't need Frankie to finish the question. Every night he asked the same ones. Do you think tomorrow she will spend time with us? Or maybe let us eat in the dining room with her, instead of in the kitchen? Mike reached over and smoothed Frankie's forehead.
Do you think she'll take us to see the fireworks at the park 'cause of 4th of July?
Frankie murmured.
Especially since Mr. Howard is out of town.
Sure, kid, whispered Mike.
Go to sleep now. Maybe tomorrow will be the day.
Chapter 14 The 4th of July came and went without mention. The Saturday following, after breakfast, Mike sat in the bedroom playing the harmonica while he and Frankie waited for Mr. Howard to take them to the park. Frankie got up from the floor where he'd been pencil drawing and went to the mirror above the dresser.
Mike, do you think I need another haircut?
Mike stopped playing and studied Frankie.
Maybe in a few weeks, but you look fine for now. Do you think I'm too noisy?
Frankie, no. Why?
Because everybody here likes us, except her. I've been leaving nosegays from the garden by her bedroom door and making pictures and leaving them at her place at the dining table. But she doesn't ever talk to us. So I was just thinking if Mr. Howard took me for a haircut or if I was quieter, then maybe...
He shrugged.
Listen, like I tell you every day, she's just getting used to us. She wasn't expecting boys.
Or two of anything.
And it takes some folks longer than others to warm up. At least we're not at Bishop's, and we're together. Right?
Frankie nodded.
Right. You know, sometimes I feel guilty we have so many nice things now, when so many other kids don't have anything, said Mike. You ever feel that way?
Frankie nodded.
I think about James... and how he's still at Bishop's with shoes too small, and I have new ones.
Same here. I think about Mouse living on the streets, and wonder what he's going to do when it gets cold. And here I have a bed full of blankets.
I think about these things a lot, about how come it was us and not someone else got picked to come here. We're the lucky ones, kid.
Frankie gave him a wobbly smile. Mike wished he believed his own words. But even though they had so much, too many things still didn't add up. And even though Mrs. Potter had said Mike would get used to things not making sense, after 3 weeks he hadn't, and that worried him. There was something big gnawing at him, a question far more confounding than a piano in the music room that sorely needed playing. Mrs. Potter appeared in the doorway.
Mr. Howard is here. Frankie, let's get you cleaned up a bit.
Is she coming with us?
Asked Frankie. Mike looked at Mrs. Potter and caught the look of pity in her eyes and the almost imperceptible shake of her head. She put on a smile.
Not today, but lots of vendors are still in the park, being it's just after the holiday. You'll enjoy it.
She took Frankie's hand and led him from the room. Mike heard voices from the open window. He stepped closer. Down below, Mrs. Sturbridge and Mr. Howard stood on the front walk. She was dressed for town in her usual black, carrying gloves and a handbag. Mr. Howard had his hands on his hips. You're going to see Golding today? Why don't you come with us?
I'm trying to undo what's been done.
They're good boys, Uni, and talented. You'd see that if you gave them a chance. Whatever Mrs. Sturbridge said next, was so quiet that Mike couldn't hear, but her gaze dropped to the ground. Mr. Howard shook his head. I know you've suffered, Uni. But so have those boys. I'm sorry I put you in a situation that was far different from what you were expecting. I was doing my best, given that time was running out. You know, all your father ever wanted was for this house to be filled with children and music and for you to open your heart again. She looked up at Mr. Howard.
What good has opening my heart ever done? Everyone who matters to me leaves me.
That's not true. I never left you. Not on the playground when you were a girl and lost your mother. Not when you married a man your father didn't approve of. I stayed at your side when little Henry and your father... He choked up and his voice cracked. I never left through all of it. And I'm still here. But if this is your way of telling me that I don't matter to you, then maybe it's time I move on. He turned and walked into the house. Her eyes followed him. She looked up and caught Mike watching her from the window. He felt the blood rush to his face. Would she be angry he was eavesdropping? She didn't look mad. She looked as if she might cry. Before he could blink, she spun around and strode to the Packard, where Mr. Potter held the door open. Mike watched the car pull away, more questions taunting him. What did her dead father have to do with their adoption? Who was Henry? And what was she trying to undo?
Chapter 15. As they walked toward the park, Mr. Howard didn't talk or whistle, and the spring in his step was gone. When they passed his house, Frankie asked,
Have you ever climbed those trees?
Mr. Howard shook his head. Not since I was a boy. But you boys can climb them any time you like.
Mike won't ever, 'cause he's afraid of heights.
Is that true, Mike? Mike nodded.
I'm afraid of spiders, said Frankie. What are you afraid of, sir?
Frankie, these days I'm afraid of losing everything I ever cared about. He looked from Frankie to Mike. And I'm afraid of losing the things I'm beginning to care about.
Like us?
Asked Frankie. Mr. Howard smiled, but looked sad, too. Mike felt a pang in his heart. You see, I had hoped that one day Uni and I might... Mr. Howard frowned.
Get married?
Asked Frankie. Mr. Howard blushed. Even his freckles looked brighter.
You love her?
Asked Frankie. He flung out his hands. It might not matter anymore. I have an opportunity with my firm to transfer to San Francisco at the end of the year. I haven't told them yes or no yet. Frankie took his hand.
Please don't go.
I can't promise to stay, he said. It depends on what happens here. Mike puzzled. What needed to happen for Mr. Howard to stay? As they approached the park, Frankie ran ahead and joined some boys playing ball. Mike and Mr. Howard sat on a bench. What would become of them if Mr. Howard left? There'd be no more Saturday outings, no more playing ball on the lawn, no more checkers after dinner. Without him around, the house would seem bigger, their lives emptier, especially since Mrs. Sturbridge barely spoke to them. Mike took a deep breath, the big question burning in his stomach. He forced himself to ask it.
Mr. Howard, sir, how come Mrs. Sturbridge adopted us? We've hardly seen her since we got here. Even though we look presentable now, she still doesn't seem to want us.
Mr. Howard took off his hat and stared at it, as if it held all the answers. I guess it must feel that way. I suppose you're old enough to understand and have a right to know. You see, Michael, you and Frankie... are her father's final wish.
You mean when he was dying?
Mr. Howard leaned back. Not exactly. You see, when Uni was 20, she married a violinist she met in New York at a symphony benefit. He performed abroad for months at a time, so she lived in the big house with her father. Her husband came and went. A few years later they had a son, Henry,
That house became a different place with him toddling and then running around, so full of life and laughter and joy. He became the light of Eunice and her father's lives. She and Mr. Dow spoiled him a little too much.
In the young gentleman's department, remembered Mike. Where is Henry now?
Against her wishes, Eunice's husband took him to a nearby lake one day. Henry was only 3 and couldn't swim. Her husband wasn't watching. He'd met some friends there and had his eyes on other things. And there was an accident, and Henry died. Suddenly everything became clear. Mike whispered,
"That's why she didn't want to adopt a child, especially a boy."
Mr. Howard stared into the park. She never forgave her husband. They stayed together for a few years, but he was rarely home, and soon he was squandering her money. They finally divorced, then Eunice shut out the world. She hardly ever left the house.
She still had her father, though, said Mike.
Yes, for 5 years. He was in a wheelchair by then, polio. Taking care of him gave her some purpose. But as Mr. Dow grew frailer, he worried that Eunice would never have a family. All he wanted was for her to feel joy and love again. Secretly, he changed his will, so that she would inherit his wealth only if she started proceedings to adopt a child within 1 year of his death, preferably a child who was musical. Otherwise, everything would go to charity, including the house. Eunice hadn't performed with an orchestra for years, so if she didn't oblige, she would have no income.
Was she surprised? Asked Mike.
That's putting it mildly. Angry, surprised, indignant, and sad that her father had died on top of it. At first, she said she wouldn't dishonor Henry's life by replacing him with another child. She tried to get the will changed, but her father was clever. It's almost ironclad. She put off adopting until the year deadline was only weeks away. That's when she sent me to choose a child for her, so she'd be within the law. To buy her more time. Mr. Howard looked at Mike, apologetic.
I thought our adoption was final.
The papers have been filed, but they don't become legal until 3 months have passed. You were adopted the 2nd week of June. The 2nd week of September, it will be said and done. Mike's stomach began to churn. So that's what she meant when she said, I'm trying to undo what's been done. That's why they'd hardly seen her. She didn't want to spend any time with them. She was trying to get rid of them. Mike, are you all right? Mike said slowly.
So we were brought here so the lawyers could have an extra 3 months to figure out how she can unadopt us?
Mr. Howard nervously rotated his hat around and around. I'm sorry. He put an arm on Mike's shoulder. Mike pulled away, choking out his words.
How soon is she going to send us back? Just tell me, Mr. Howard. I have to know.
Legally, she's only required to adopt one child. I suppose she could send you both back and start proceedings on another child. As long as the adoption process is underway, she meets the criteria. But that's not likely to happen. Mike felt as if he'd been scrambling up a cliff. But just as he reached the top, he slipped and fell to the bottom.
So she could just keep adopting a different boy every 3 months until the waiting period is up? And make him think he is going to live in a beautiful house, have good things to eat, and get nice clothes, and spend time with you? And then, when he gets his hopes up that something right is finally happening in his life, she will send him back to Bishop's?
Mike, I don't think it will ever come to that. Mike's mind raced, and his words tumbled.
I gotta look out for Frankie. Bishop's won't be taking any lowers come September, and he just can't go to the state home. Kids die there!
Mike clenched his fists.
Why did you choose us if you knew? Maybe another family would have come along. Maybe a family who cared about us would have...
He choked back a lump in his throat. Mike, listen to me. When I met you and Frankie, I knew immediately there was something special about you boys.
I lost my own brother in the war, and I'd give anything to have him back. I couldn't separate you. That day at Bishop's, it became apparent that Mrs. Pennyweather intended to do just that. I figured if I brought you here, you and Frankie would be safely together for at least the summer, and hopefully longer. Mike dropped his head. I knew it was too good to be true, Mr. Howard said quietly. It will all be good and true in the end. I'm hanging my hat on it. He blew out a long breath. You know, Mike, she wasn't always closed off and distant. Grief did that to her. She was such a loving mother, and when she was with Henry, her happiness just spilled over. She could be, can be, quite wonderful, and so talented. She was a concert pianist, you know. When she walked out on stage, my heart and the whole world stood still. I admit that bringing you and Frankie here was a risk, but I still think it was the right thing. Can't we hope for the best? How could Mike hope for the best when the worst seemed so much more probable? He didn't answer. Mr. Howard sighed and patted Mike on the back. I would adopt you myself if the law allowed a single man to do such a thing, but it doesn't. He stood and walked to a vendor with a pushcart and came back with three good humor bars. He called to Frankie and waved him over. Frankie climbed up on the bench and grinned, his cheeks pink from playing.
Thank you, Mr. Howard.
He licked the dribbles from his ice cream bar as quickly as they melted. He looked up at Mike.
You're not eating. What's wrong? Nothing, kid.
Mike wasn't going to fill Frankie's mind with the prospect of the state home. Besides, it was his job to worry. Frankie finished and begged Mr. Howard to push him on a swing. Mike stayed on the bench, staring at the good humor bar, watching the chocolate slide from the vanilla center. He held it over the grass as it fell apart. First the shell, and then the insides. Chapter 16. That night, Mike couldn't sleep. The hours and his problems seemed never-ending. His mind was a fog. He watched patches of light crawl across the ceiling as the moon tried to peek through the branches of the elm in the side yard. He slid from the bed and paced, clenching and unclenching his hands, feeling as helpless as he had at Bishop's. He looked at Frankie, safe and fed and sound asleep, his mouth curled in a smile. Mike picked up the harmonica and leaned on the windowsill, looking out. The North Star gleamed. Softly, he began a slow and simple rendition of Home Sweet Home. Missed Granny. He wished he could be little again, leaning against her on the piano bench while she gave lessons. What should he do now? She had said the right person would find them. But who? And where was the path he should take? The second time through the song, he broke up the tune like Mr. Potter had taught him, sprinkling in the trials and tribulations in his heart. Mr. Potter's words played in his mind. It's about what folks want, but don't have. No matter how much you don't have, there's always so much more of life to be had. There's equal amount of, maybe things will get better someday soon. His clouded thoughts began to thin. Frankie wanted a family. Mrs. Sturbridge needed to fulfill her father's final wish. One child would do that. One child was what she'd been expecting. Would she be more inclined to keep Frankie if Mike were out of the picture? He filled up on the music and on an idea. He lowered the harmonica and turned it over in his hands. The moonlight caught it and it glowed. He traced a finger over the M. He closed his eyes. Where could he go?
If he went back to Bishop's and was put out to hire or ran away, Frankie would be devastated. But if Mike did something else, like audition and join the harmonica band, the kid would be thrilled for him. He slipped away from the windowsill and took his metal box from a drawer in the dresser. He pulled out the newspaper article from the Inquirer and ran his finger across the headline. Huxley's Harmonica Wizards. Mike's eyes scanned the page, searching for the paragraph he needed. The band has the support and philanthropy of their own women's auxiliary. In cases where children are itinerant and in need, Mr. Hoxie and the women's auxiliary have taken in exceptional players and placed them with patron families so they can experience the dynamic benefits of the band and its musical camaraderie while living in a home environment. If Mike made the band, he wouldn't need to tell Frankie that he was planning to live with another family until later. By then, it would be September, and time for school to start. He'd make sure Frankie saw this as a big opportunity for Mike. He'd pretend it was what he'd always wanted. He'd promise to come home between tours. He'd tell his brother anything to keep him safe. Convincing Frankie would be the easy part. The rest would only work if he was chosen by Hoxie, and if she could open her heart again. What had Mouse said? Everybody has a heart. Sometimes you gotta work hard to find it. If there's something you want or need to know from grown folks, you gotta step up and ask for it mannerly. Plead your case. Mike went back to bed, put her protective arm around Frankie, and fell asleep with a familiar burden, wondering about all the things that could go wrong. Chapter 17. Mike was grateful to have a plan, but putting it in motion proved harder than he'd thought. All week he watched for Mrs. Sturbridge, but saw her only in fleeting moments. When she was home, she stayed in her bedroom or in the library with the door closed, and was not to be disturbed. If she was in the garden and Mike came out, she hurried in. It was only after Mike and Frankie went upstairs in the evening that she came down. Each time he asked Mrs. Potter about her whereabouts, she shook her head and said, "Meetings with lawyers again." By Saturday morning, Mike was tied up in knots with worry. It was already the middle of July. The summer was moving too fast. Time would soon run out. Before Mr. Howard arrived to take them to the park, Mike saw his chance. He took a deep breath and knocked on the library doors.
"Come in."
He stepped inside, where she sat at the desk with a pen in her hand.
"Yes?"
"Ma'am, I...
Mike's breath shortened. He patted his shirt pocket and felt a pulse of reassurance from the harmonica.
"What is it, Michael? I'm very busy. I'll be leaving for an appointment soon, and I have things..."
Mike looked at the floor. His chest felt tight. He tried to unscramble the words in his head.
"I know why you brought us here," he managed. "Mr. Howard told me about your father's will and how you were forced to adopt us, and about your son. I guess that's why you didn't want boys."
She frowned and set the pen on the desk.
"It wasn't Mr. Howard's place to say those things. I'll speak to him about that. It wasn't his fault. I asked him straight out why we were here. I knew there was something wrong. The way you act around us, well, it isn't hard to figure out that you don't want us."
He took a deep breath.
"I'd like to know if what Mrs. Potter and Mr. Howard said about you is true."
She raised an eyebrow.
"And what exactly did they say?"
She stood and walked to the window.
"Mrs. Potter said you were a kind and loving soul underneath all the rest. I guess that means your heart's so sad that it's hard to get out from under the weight. When I was sad about my mother dying, Granny used to say, 'Grief is the heaviest thing to carry alone.' So I know all about that."
She stood in profile, gazing into the yard, and frowned. Was she already unhappy with what he was saying? Mouse's words urged him to keep going. "Plead your case."
Mr. Howard said you were a loving mother and that when you were with your son, your happiness spilled over. He said you were talented, too, and that you can be wonderful. So if all that is true, I was wondering if you would consider keeping Frankie. You see, if you send us back to Bishop's, they'll put Frankie in the state home, and it's not fit for river rats. I couldn't bear to think of what might happen to him there. He's little, and he needs someone to look after him. See, I am the lucky one. I remember our mother.
Mike bit the inside of his cheek so he wouldn't cry.
But Frankie doesn't.
He took another deep breath, and his voice cracked.
And Granny, well, she was the next best thing, but now she's gone too, and Frankie needs a mother. I see the way he looks at you. He's just hoping you'll notice him and want him. That's why he's been drawing pictures for you and leaving flowers at your door and asking me every night if tomorrow you'll spend time with him.
She turned and faced him, slowly shaking her head. His thoughts poured out.
I promise he wouldn't be trying to take the place of your son, and he wouldn't need to call you mother either. Maybe you could be like his aunt. We never had an aunt.
Mike didn't know where all his words were coming from.
Mr. Howard told me you only have to keep one child. I thought a lot on this. I could leave. I could try out for Hoxie's harmonica band. See, if you make the band and you don't have a home, the director, Hoxie, he finds you one. Mr. Potter says I'm as fine a player as he's ever heard, so maybe I have a chance. If I got in the band, I could live with the host family until I'm old enough to join the army. You wouldn't have to worry about me. The only one you'd have to look after is Frankie.
She whispered.
Is that what you want, Michael? If it means Frankie can stay, then I guess it's what I want. And if I don't make the band, you could send me back to Bishop's, as long as I could visit Frankie now and again. I just have to see him sometimes, and he needs to see me.
Mike swiped at his eyes.
If he was here with you, no matter if I was back at Bishop's or working on a farm somewhere or in the band, at least I'd have the peace of mind, knowing he was safe and not being bullied.
Mrs. Sturbridge put a hand over her mouth. Had his words made her feel queasy? Mike couldn't stop now.
Frankie likes Mr. and Mrs. Potter real well, and Mr. Howard, he's the closest thing Frankie ever had to a father. That is, if he doesn't move to San Francisco. He doesn't want to move. One word from you, and he'd stay right here forever. He loves you.
Tears welled in her eyes. The doorbell rang.
That's Mr. Howard, here to take us to the park,
said Mike. She nodded and whispered,
Then you better go along. Ma'am, this is the nicest place he'll ever find. It's the nicest place anyone would ever find. My granny said that finery and fancy houses don't make one bit of difference unless the person who owns them has a heart as beautiful. So if it's all true, what they say about you being kind and loving and wonderful, could you keep Frankie?
She turned back toward the window and stood as still as a statue. But Mike was sure he saw tears rolling down the side of her cheek. If only he knew what they meant. Chapter 18. As they walked to the park, Mike couldn't shake the feeling that he'd forgotten something. But what? He touched his head to make sure he'd remembered his cap and put his hand into his pocket to make sure the harmonica was still there. Had he forgotten to say something? He still couldn't tell if Mrs. Sturbridge was more inclined to keep Frankie, or if he had made matters worse. Should he have apologized for making her cry? Or for his boldness? Should he have at least told Mrs. Potter she was upset?
Mr. Howard, sir, I'm going back to the house, said Mike. I forgot to do something.
Are you sure? Mr. Howard asked. Mike nodded, smiled to reassure him, and turned back.
I'll see you later,
he called. As Mike drew closer to the house, he noticed the Packard was still out front. Hadn't Mr. Potter left to take Mrs. Sturbridge to her appointment yet? He went around to the kitchen and quietly slipped inside. Mr. Potter sat at the kitchen table, his head tilted to the side, gazing off, a small smile on his face.
Mrs. Potter stood at the sink, motionless, her eyes wide and a hand over her heart. Mike took a step closer to them. When Mrs. Potter saw Mike, she quickly raised one finger over her mouth to tell him not to make a sound. What was wrong? Why did he have to be... Suddenly, he understood. The piano. Someone was playing the Chopin Nocturne, number 20, the same piece he had played his first morning there, except this. This was masterful. Was it her? Mike felt himself drawn forward. He took a few careful steps into the hall. One of the doors to the music room was halfway open. He stepped behind it and peeked through the crack of the door jamb. Mrs. Sturbridge sat at the keyboard, poised and elegant, her arms and head leaning into the music as it filled the room. Mike breathed it in, almost sighing with the emotion of it. Mr. Howard was right. The world seemed to stand still. Riveted, he felt his eyelids drop as he was swept into the piece. Moments later, he was jarred from his trance by an angry clamor. He peered into the room again and saw Mrs. Sturbridge pounding on the keys. He felt a hauntingly familiar tremor in his bones. In his mind's eye, he was back in Granny's parlor, hammering on the piano, sadness traveling from his heart to his fingers, filling the room with grief. He blinked back tears. He knew this pain. Mrs. Sturbridge pushed away from the piano, stood, and swung her arm at the prop. The lid crashed in a deafening clap. She dropped to the piano bench and collapsed across the keyboard, burying her head in the crook of an elbow. She trembled from her sobbing, dissonant notes erupting with each heave of her body. Mike pressed himself against the wall, his eyes stinging. As Mrs. Potter rushed past him, he stayed frozen. He still hadn't moved when she emerged with her arm around Mrs. Sturbridge, now a limp rag doll, and guided her upstairs. Was all this his fault? Had he asked for too much? Chapter 19. For most of the week, Mrs. Potter shuttled from the kitchen to Mrs. Sturbridge's room, taking her meals on trays and shushing everyone because the missus needed to rest. Mike dragged around his guilt. He still hadn't told anyone about his conversation with her. He wanted to apologize, but he couldn't see how or when. The nosegays Frankie left by her door withered. His drawings collected by her place at the dining table. Mr. Howard came to visit, but Mrs. Sturbridge refused to see him. He half-heartedly played catch on the lawn with Frankie, or sat on the porch and played checkers, letting the kid win every game. By Thursday, Mrs. Potter said that if the Mrs. didn't perk up soon, she would call the doctor. Mike was so distraught, thinking she might have to go to the hospital, he told Mr. Howard everything. Mr. Howard only patted him on the shoulder and said Mike had given her the best medicine possible. But Mike hadn't a clue what that meant. Late that night, he finally heard talking coming from the library, and the voices sounded like Mrs. Sturbridge's and Mr. Howard's. The murmurings were low and somber, so he couldn't make out what they were saying. Had she come to a decision about him and Frankie? A knot in Mike's stomach tightened. The next evening, as Mike and Frankie readied for bed, there was a knock on the bedroom door. Mike opened it, expecting Mrs. Potter, and was surprised to find Mrs. Sturbridge. She wore a dressing gown with a shawl wrapped around her and looked weary-eyed. "Michael, a word with you, please." He stepped from the room and closed the door. Before she could say anything, he blurted, "Ma'am, about the other day, I'm sorry if I upset." She held up a hand and shook her head. "You needn't apologize. I've thought about what you asked of me. I hadn't considered your and Franklin's circumstances. I see now..." She frowned and fidgeted with the fringe on the end of the shawl. "I've come to tell you that
If this arrangement is what you really want, then I will agree to it. But I want you to know that no matter what happens with the band...
The bedroom door swung open. Frankie stood before them looking hopeful.
Do you want a word with me, too?
Her eyes softened.